The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is cracking down on the e-cigarette industry. We're looking at the takeaways on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The FDA, it continues to review whether one leading maker, Juul Labs, can sell its vaping products in the U.S., but the FDA recently rejected nearly 1 million e-cigarette and related products from being sold. Do you vape? How did you decide what product to choose? Are you concerned about the potential side effects and lung health in particular? It's 800-642-1234. Jeffrey Hardesty is a research associate at the Institute for Global Tobacco Control at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Jeffrey, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Good morning. The FDA is tasked with reviewing over 6.5 million tobacco product applications. Can you explain what is a pre-market review?
Yeah, absolutely. So a pre-market review is an FDA-led review of new product applications that e-cigarette and tobacco companies hope to put on the market in the future or keep on the market, as is the case during this current review period. So companies have to submit a bunch of required information and documents about their products, including information that would allow the FDA to decide whether allowing the product on the market has the potential for a net public health benefit.
How long do these reviews take?
You know, the deadline for submitting the applications was, I believe, September of 2020, and We're just now hearing the results now. So about a year and change, yeah.
You know, we've heard about Juul and the FDA not taking a stand there. Why is the FDA has yet to make a decision on, you know, the really big e-cigarette maker?
You know, I think it's hard to know. It's hard to know. It's pretty speculative to say at this point. You know, the reasons for it, you know, could be, you know, there could be a number of reasons. I would say, you know, not the least of which is the fact that they had 6.5 million applications to go through. Mm. You know, it's an unenviable task, to say the least. So, where they could have done a better job in this situation is probably providing a clear timeline for their impending decision on Juul. And that's simply because every day that they wait, you know, more and more kids are going to get hooked on nicotine.
And when you look at kids getting hooked on nicotine, what do you see there, especially in states and localities that have restricted or banned the sale of flavored e-cigarettes before this point? What has been the effect on teen tobacco use?
Yeah, I think we're still learning that. It's still early. There's only a couple states at this point that have those rules in place. I think the early evidence is suggesting that, you know, these are effective policies, but we're just going to have to kind of wait and see.
Yeah. So the FDA rejects more than 946,000 flavored vaping products, saying they lack sufficient evidence that they have a benefit to adult smokers, compared to the public health risk that they pose to kids and teens. But based on your research, is that evidence holding true?
The evidence that people are... can you repeat the question?
Sure. Yeah. Because the FDA is rejecting these flavored products, does that make them more risky for users? What is the risk factor?
I see. So because they're rejecting them, I would say that right now what we're likely going to see in the marketplace is that you're going to see some kind of consolidation. I think that these products are still going to be available, you know, for adults who want to buy them. I think it's just going to be a marketplace that has products that the FDA has deemed to have the potential for a net public health benefit, or in this case, you know, devices that they haven't made a decision on. So I think that it's still going to be okay. I think, the products themselves aren't going to be changing necessarily as a result of this.
Jeffrey Hardesty is a research associate at the Institute for Global Tobacco Control at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. As we look at the health impact and the policies surrounding the e-cigarette industry, the latest moves of the FDA, do you vape? How did you decide what product to use? Are you concerned about side effects of vaping? Do you work in a shop that sells vape and e-cigarette products? What are you seeing and hearing? 800-642-1234. You know, Jeffrey, there are really two pressing questions. Have scientists, you know, figured out, is vaping bad for you? And are e-cigarettes just as addictive as traditional ones?
Yeah, I think the short answer is that we don't know yet. And I'm sorry if that seems like it's going to be a theme of this. I think in particular for the long-term effects, we don't really fully understand that yet. And I think the reason for that can be summarized as, you know, cancer takes 20 to 30 years to develop in people, right? Mm. And e-cigarettes have really only been around in the US since 2006 and really only popular for the last 5 or 6 years. So I think it's just going to take some time before we can fully understand these long-term impacts. What we can say is that we know these aerosolized liquids have heavy metals in them. That includes things like arsenic and chromium, lead, nickel that are present in the aerosol. And these are known carcinogens. So we know that they're at lower concentrations relative to combustible cigarettes. But as people may or may not know, just because it has a lower dose of these carcinogens does not necessarily equate to fewer bad outcomes, unless we know something about the dose response relationship, which is, as you know, you increase the number of toxicants, you expect to see an increased number of bad outcomes. And so, you know, given that that would be an unethical study on humans, I think we're just kind of stuck trying to wait and see, over the next, several years, what we see happening in people. And it's for that reason and those uncertainties that I'm of the opinion that people who, you know, the only people who should really be using e-cigarettes are people who've worked with their doctors. They've tried other ways to quit that are known to be safe and effective, such as nicotine replacement therapy, and none of that has worked. And so mm-hmm. The people who are using, you know, should of course know that, you know, there are a lot of these unknowns and, you know, bad outcomes still could happen.
You mentioned e-cigarettes and everything being pretty new here. They were not under FDA regulation until 2016. And since then, the FDA has been fairly hands-off on regulating vaping products until we saw the lawsuits, until anti-tobacco groups, you know, came into the picture. Why has it taken that long for the FDA to really take a hard look at vaping?
Yeah, I think most of us in the tobacco control community were hoping the FDA could have acted sooner on this. Obviously, that didn't happen. You know, I think I'm just glad that it's happening now. We're all, you know, a bit disappointed, even in this case, to not see the results, you know, for all the applications. But we really shouldn't rush to judgment, I think, too much, at least in the current moment. You know, I think there could be a number of reasons for this, you know, for the delays right now and, you know, also for the delays in the past. You know, there could be, again, like I was mentioning before, there could be a number of reasons for that, you know, mm-hmm. some political, some legal, those types of things. You know, so I think we just have to be patient in this case, too.
I know it's hard to speculate, but will banning these flavored vaping products, will that lead to a more active, a more robust underground market or illegal trafficking of these products?
You know, I don't think so. Obviously, I don't have a crystal ball and I can't say anything with certainty, but, you know, these products are still going to be available for adults who, you know, want to use them to quit smoking, right? So it's just going to be fewer on the market. There might be fewer kid appealing flavors. There will still probably be flavors on the market. You know, I think, you know, when you start adding additional obstacles to the process in order to vape, you know, I think you're going to see people not, you know, maybe there will be some people who want to do that, but I don't think that you're going to see people putting in a ton of effort to do those types of things, you know, like making your own nicotine liquid that you vape or something like that. We know that that happens, but I just don't think that it'll happen in mass.
We're talking with Jeffrey Hardesty, who studies vaping patterns and the consequences of domestic and international e-cigarette and tobacco policies. Based at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, do you work in a smoke shop that sells vape and e-cigarette products? What is your sense on what the FDA has done? Have you used vape products to curb your cigarette smoking? Did it work? And if new federal taxes were imposed on vaping products, would that change your use at all? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. The Food and Drug Administration rejected the applications of more than 900,000 makers of e-cigarettes and related products this month. We're getting takeaways from this move and how Juul, the largest vape company, is not included in the FDA's action. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So rewind a couple years ago, there was an outbreak of vaping-related lung illnesses documented closely here in Wisconsin. It triggered a CDC investigation. And in January of 2020, the Trump administration announced a ban on some popular e-cigarette flavors to curb the rise of teen vaping. Have you had lung damage from vaping? What can you tell us? Have you tried to stop vaping only to find yourself more addicted to the products? It's 800-642-1234. We have Jeffrey Hardesty, who is a scientist at Johns Hopkins University studying e-cigarettes, staying with us. Let's bring in Andrew now in Waukesha. Andrew, hi.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I just had a quick question. Does the guest think that it's the government's place to tell people what they can or can't consume, whether it be tobacco or alcohol? And what are your thoughts on the seeming pattern of whenever the government finds something that they believe is unhealthy for people, that they try to tax it out of consumption? Thank you.
Yeah, Andrew, thank you. And Andrew alluding to there, you know, we learned yesterday the Biden administration is looking to raise taxes on tobacco and impose new taxes on vaping. And just kind of get at your sense, will higher prices do anything to deter people and teens from using tobacco?
Yeah, so I think in terms of, you know, my philosophy on government, you know, I think adults should have the ability to choose, you know, what they want to do. And, you know, I think in this case, you know, we're not talking about banning e-cigarettes, you know, in their entirety. I think what we're looking at is potentially getting rid of a lot of kid appealing flavors, you know, and adults will still be able to vape. They'll still be able to get certain flavors. But what we're really trying to do here is curb use among kids, right? We have 1 in 5 high schoolers who are currently using e-cigarettes, and among them, 61% are using 20 or more days in the last month. That's heavy use, and you know, these are not kids who ordinarily would be picking up cigarettes. And when you combine all that with the fact that you know, we know that these products have harmful ingredients in them that will cause, you know, harmful impacts later in life, you know, I think it'd be really hard to sit idly by and do nothing when we have tools at our disposal to help that, to help them. In terms of tax on e-cigarettes, you know, I'm not an expert in e-cigarette tax. I know that with tobacco tax, every time it's one of the most effective policies that you can have in place to prevent people from using. Again, I don't view that as a ban. I view it as, you know, we're trying to get rid of, or not try to get rid of, but try to dissuade people from using these products, especially the more price sensitive groups like kids.
You know, when you talk about kids and the FDA, you know, rejecting products with flavors like Apple Crumble, Dr. Cola, and Cinnamon Toast Cereal designed to really appeal to those kid groups, what is the impact of those flavors and the impact of the nicotine content on kids and teens?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could just use the example of Juul. You know, before Juul came around, you know, these e-cigarettes, you know, in 2015, early 2016 were not, you know, sleek, cool devices. These were nerdy, bulky devices. And Juul came along and, you know, they had this really sleek device, and they combined that with, you know, a really savvy, you know, celebrity and social media marketing campaign with, you know, they're flashing like these types of, you know, fun flavors. And, you know, what you end up getting in combination with the very high levels of nicotine is you end up with this public health nightmare. And, you know, a number of brands, you know, have since, you know, tried to capture that same kind of marketing energy. And, you know, it's kind of a race to see, you know, who can have, you know, the more appealing flavors, right? And that's how you end up getting things like labeling that looks like Mott's applesauce, or that looks like Sour Patch Kids, or, you know, it has unicorns on it, you know, and these types of things, they appeal to kids, right? And so it's not, it shouldn't be terribly surprising to people that, you know, kids, you know, are interested in that.
How can these companies get away with that type of marketing?
You know, the FCC is trying to crack down on that, and they have been, but, you know, government isn't, you know, they don't have, you know, all of the, like, infinite resources at their disposal, right? So it's, you know, people can report that they're seeing that these products are for sale, and the FCC can look into it. And they're working closely with FDA on that. You know, but at the end of the day, it's a bit of a game of whack-a-mole, right? Like, you get rid of one and a couple more pop up. So, you know, it's really a resources issue.
Jeffrey, what is the status of the FDA regulating menthol with e-cigarettes and that minty flavor that's supposed to make tobacco products easier to start and harder to quit?
Yeah, so the Biden administration just announced in the last couple of months that they're going to be pursuing a menthol ban, you know, for not just e-cigarettes, but all tobacco products. And right now it's pretty light on details, you know, what that's going to include. You know, we know that there's going to be a public comment period coming up, you know, and we're all eagerly awaiting that, you know, and additional details to come out about what the specifics are, you know, around this new policy. So far, we haven't heard anything. We're all just kind of waiting right now and, you know, hoping that that happens sooner rather than later.
Can you give us more sense of what the impact of menthol is on tobacco products and kind of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So specifically with smoking cigarettes, right? Like, these are, so menthol, you can think of it as, you know, this chemical that kind of dulls or nulls, you know, the feeling that you have, you know, when you're smoking. So, you know, nicotine in its usual form is a very abrasive, kind of harsh chemical, right? And so when you combine that with menthol, which has this cooling sensation, you actually can make the nicotine a lot more palatable to the end user. And, you know, the really troubling thing with menthol is that who is using it, right? So this is very commonly used, you know, among minority populations, including Black Americans. So, you know, it's disproportionately high in these groups. You know, the FDA had a chance to ban this, I think back in 2009, and when they banned other flavored cigarettes, but they allowed menthol to remain on the market. And, you know, as a, you know, subsequent to that, you know, it's a game of whack-a-mole, right? Like, you can maybe stop people from using flavors, but then you get more people using, you know, the flavors that are available. In this case, menthol use actually increased. So I'm very relieved, as are many people, to hear that they're, you know, going to be trying to ban menthol. But we're all just going to have to wait and see.
Talking with Jeffrey Hardesty, who's a research associate at the Johns Hopkins Institute for Global Tobacco Controls, we discussed the health impacts and regulations of the e-cigarette and tobacco industry with your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Jeffrey, you study the potential benefits and consequences of tobacco policy. What are you currently studying?
Yeah, so we're actually looking at what are the potential benefits and unintended consequences of potential policies that the FDA may or may not be interested in in the future. You know, some of those things include reducing the amount of nicotine that would be present in the liquids. Another would be limiting the amount of nicotine over a period of time rather than just in an absolute sense. And then also in terms of flavor restrictions. So we're currently in the data collection phase for most of this, you know, but we're really interested to see, you know, if we can see patterns in current use, you know, that might be suggestive of what we might see in, you know, in terms of benefits and unintended consequences.
Yeah, in terms of the patterns of use by people who use e-cigarettes, are they hard to quit?
They can be. I think what we're likely to see as we learn more about these devices, you know, this is a very diverse product class. You know, everybody thinks of Juul, but You know, there's disposables. You know, there's these devices that you can modify the power, you can modify the coils, you know, you can manage the entire experience. So I think, and that's just on the device side. You know, on the liquid side, you can get all different levels of nicotine. There's chemically modified nicotine that makes it smoother and easier to vape, similar to it's not menthol, but it's in that same kind of vein. That's what its function is. And, you know, so I think it's going to be highly varied depending, you know, on the individual user and, you know, what, you know, they're using.
Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Hardesty is a research associate at the Institute for Global Tobacco Control at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Just ahead, a Wisconsin hunter explains tracking techniques and how hunting dogs recover wounded deer. Are you preparing for the deer opener? Do you hunt deer with a crossbow? How does it feel when a big buck comes into view? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Deer hunting season is upon us, and we're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The DNR proclaims whitetail deer hunting in Wisconsin is the fabric of our hunting heritage. The deer are an iconic and important part of the Wisconsin landscape and culture, end quote. What strategies do you use to track deer when you're hunting? Do you have a hunting dog? Which breed is it? Have you had success using your hunting dog to track deer? Join in 800-642-1234. Linda Bennett is co-owner of Spring Valley Tracking and Game Recovery. The business provides tracking for wounded deer with the use of Bavarian mountain hounds. Linda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good morning. So hunters call you when they can't find deer that they've shot. You have these Bavarian mountain hounds to track wounded deer. Can you explain what the dogs do once they arrive?
Yes, of course. Sometimes, especially in the case of an archery shot, sometimes for whatever reason, and there can be several, there is no visible sign of a wounded deer. For whatever reason, maybe there's no blood trail, for instance. So we come in with our dogs and just get them set up. And our dogs are actually trained to follow an actual, it's a scent that's emitted from a wounded deer through an interdigital gland in their hoof. So they don't actually need blood. So they can determine what the path was that wounded deer took. And oftentimes we can help that hunter locate that deer that may not have been otherwise recovered.
How do these dogs have this skill? How are they taught to do this?
Well, it's a process, and we like to start when they're very little puppies. And like any kind of dog training, you start out making it really simple and fun, and you just keep it making it harder and harder. When we start with a puppy, we do actually use blood. We make a simulated trail, and then we just start taking the blood away. And we use an actual hoof from a deer that was wounded, and we put down a track. There are special tracking shoes that you can put a hoof into, and we get it so that dog will eventually follow a track with absolutely no blood. And be able to, even though there have been other deer in the area, they can pick out the one that's wounded and get to the quarry.
About how long does it take for a dog to track down a wounded deer?
Oh, boy. It always depends on a lot of deer. And a lot of things affect how easy it's going to be to find a deer. The weather plays into it. And surprisingly, rain and snow are not necessarily always a bad thing. Seems like barometric pressure often will affect the scent. Dry weather is worse than a nice damp day, but it just very much depends. Sometimes we get out to a site and we'll have the deer in 10 minutes, and sometimes we spend hours. It just depends on so many different factors.
What about the dark? What about nightfall? Does that have any impact? Although, you know, these dogs are using not, you know, other senses, of course.
Right. A lot of trackers that I know like to track at night. They feel that there are less distractions for the dog, and they feel like they can see any, if there is any visible blood, they feel like they can see it better with their headlamp. Personally, I don't care to go out and tramp around in the woods at night, so I don't care to track at night. But a lot of times when hunters call us and they've got a situation where they've wounded a deer and they can't find it, a lot of times we will tell them to leave it until the next morning. Mm. Just because depending on how a deer is wounded, we can usually advise them. Sometimes, depending on where the deer was hit, sometimes if you go after that deer right away, you're just going to keep pushing it. And especially in the case of, for instance, a big mature buck, sometimes you might just push them out of the countryside and into the next county if you get on that trail right away.
Because they can sense the dogs are coming.
Yes, yes. Again, it depends on where the deer is hit. You know, yeah. Sometimes if you just let them go and get someplace quiet and let them settle down, you can go in a little bit later and make the find. But if you push them, even if it's a mortal hit, sometimes you're just not going to catch up with them.
And I know you want to make a distinction here and crystal clear that these hunting dogs are not going after deer that have not been wounded.
Yes, exactly. And so a couple things here. We train our dogs that they should not get on the track of a healthy deer. And the other thing, too, in Wisconsin, it's only legal to use a dog for tracking if they are on a leash. So we use a 30-foot lead. And the whole idea is people need to understand that we are not hunting with these dogs. This is after the fact, and we are merely a recovery service. So we don't ever want anyone to think that we are actually pursuing healthy deer with dogs.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Linda Bennett about deer tracking. She co-owns a business that uses these hounds to track wounded deer for hunters. Do you have a hunting dog? Which breed is it? Have you had success using your hunting dog to track deer? How big was your buck? Join in at 800-642-1234. Linda, are there other dog breeds that are used to recover deer that have been wounded?
Yes, and we tell people, really, any dog can track. Some breeds are more have a better propensity for it, depending on how they're bred, but every dog has millions of scent receptors in their nose, and they can just scent things that we're not even able to be aware of. But some dogs are better suited. Bloodhounds, for instance, some of our pointing breeds can do a very good job at tracking. However, they are bred to do more air scenting, so they're more apt to run with a high head. So you want something, a dog that just has a natural affinity for keeping their nose lower. So certain breeds are bred specifically for tracking, as are Bavarians. But truly, you can track with any dog. It just is a matter of putting the time in for the training.
You know, how much can the tracks of a deer on the trails tell you about the deer that is leaving those markers? What do those tracks tell you?
You know, you can tell a lot by if there's, first of all, wherever the deer was standing when it was hit. And again, usually we're tracking, most of our tracks are for archery deer. So if you can find the arrow, the type of blood or any kind of matter and the hair that's left on that arrow will give you clues as to where the deer was hit. Anything around the site where the deer was standing, again, hair or blood. The color of the blood will give you an indication, again, of where the deer was hit. For instance, if the deer was hit in the liver or the gut area, any blood that you might see would probably be a darker red color. That usually is an indication that you should wait a little while before you get on that track. Versus a bright red blood sign is usually indicative of a muscle hit deer or something that usually a bright red blood is less likely to be a mortally wounded deer because deer have different clotting abilities than people. And plus they are very, very tough. So a lot of times people will say, oh, I've got so much blood. And then it peters out to nothing. Well, they've got a lot more vitamin K in them, and they just clot faster. And a lot of times you'll think that you've really wounded a deer, but actually they kind of get their composure together and
they're on their way.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Paul now, joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Paul. What is your story with a wounded deer? Hi, Paul.
We had a deer that was in our yard. Someone had shot it with a crossbow. Like, I think they called it a bolt. And the deer died in our yard. So we called the DNR, and they charged us, like, $15 so we could keep the antlers. But we had to pay, like, $300 to have the deer covered up so it wouldn't stink up the whole neighborhood. And if this service had been around, the guy could have recovered his deer right away. And we wouldn't have had to pay to cover up the deer.
Paul,
am I making sense?
Yeah, Paul, thank you for sharing that story. Linda, do you hear of those situations?
We do. And that's one of the things that we like to point out to people. We are actually contributing to conservation because it's just a shame. A lot of people hunt because they like venison. And it's a very healthy food, and to not be able to recover a deer, it's just a waste. So we're really happy when we can help people be ethical about their hunting and be able to recover as many animals for people as we possibly can.
Deer droppings are small and pellet-shaped. What do the droppings tell hunters about a particular deer?
Actually, the actual feces don't really tell you a whole lot.
Okay.
Other than if you see a lot of them, you know that it's a very deer-rich area. But as far as anything about that individual deer or the deer present, it doesn't really give you a lot of indication.
We have longtime hunter Linda Bennett explaining tracking techniques to find deer. Deer hunters, we want to hear from you. Do you follow deer on the ground or do you have a stand? Which technique have you found works best to find wounded deer? Will you go deer hunting this season? How are you preparing for it? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Linda Bennett here on the Ideas Network. The opening of archery and crossbow season is Saturday. We're talking about deer hunting season and how to track deer on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Linda Bennett is an avid hunter, runs a business outsourcing Bavarian mountain hounds to track wounded deer. She's a member of United Blood Trackers, an organization promoting trained tracking dogs and the ethical recovery of big game. Still time for your questions at 800-642-1234. Linda with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Linda, is there a formula, an appropriate time to wait and recover a deer, whether it's been shot with a rifle or a bow?
There isn't anything specific. Every situation is different. But what we do tell people is if you're in doubt, if you possibly think that you have not made a really good shot, you should simply back out. And when I say back out, I mean if the deer went south, you need to walk north. Even if your truck is south, you need to make a big circuitous route to get back to your truck. Because what you want to do, if you have a deer that's wounded, you want to try to not disturb them any more than you possibly have to. Let that deer go and settle down and lay down. And then I would say call a tracker, because we do get super busy in the fall. We take a ton of calls and we cannot possibly get to everyone. However, if we can't come, oftentimes we can refer you to another tracker who may be able to help you. But sometimes we can even just advise you on, here's how you should handle this. Here's where I would look. Here's how long I would wait. And we actually have people call us after the fact and say, you know what? You weren't able to come out and help me, but I took your advice and I found my deer.
Hmm.
So a lot of times, because the average hunter probably tracks maybe 20 deer in his lifetime. During season, we probably track 20 deer in a week.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
You know, we can really help people, and that's what it's all about. You know, we like to help people find their deer. It's a thrilling thing, and we get a thrill out of it too whenever we can help somebody.
Do you find that it's becoming more common for hunters to call in trackers?
Yes, very much so. We've been promoting it very heavily. We've been at sports shows, and just kind of the word is getting out. Word of mouth has been huge. We have a lot of people call and say, hey, you helped my buddy find a deer last year, and now I need help this year. So, yeah, people are calling more and more often, and there are also getting to be a lot more trackers. Usually, you need to kind of be a little bit careful, because it doesn't always work to say, oh, my buddy's got a dog. I'm going to see if he'll bring his dog out. Because if the dog isn't trained, they're kind of at a disadvantage. They're not really knowing what you're asking them to do. Mm. They don't really know what they're looking for. If you do bring a dog out that isn't an experienced tracker and it doesn't work, and now if you try to call in an actual tracking dog, having that first dog in there is probably going to make it a lot more difficult for the tracking dog.
Why is that?
Just because if you wound a deer and then if you go out and search for it yourself, and let's say you put another dog on it, every time you cross the path that wounded deer took, you're going to drag a little bit of scent with it. So all you're doing is essentially messing up the whole hit site. And now when you bring in a tracking dog, they've got to try and sort through all that and pick out what's the actual track of the deer.
Mm-hmm.
Because the scent may everywhere. So now they just have to work a lot harder. And sometimes it can be so messed up that you can't possibly track that deer just because it's so contaminated.
Are there enough big game trackers in the hunting world? And is this an organized community, an organized piece of the industry, if you will?
It is. If you're looking for a tracker, we are members of United Blood Trackers, so you can go to unitedbloodtrackers.org, and there you can learn a lot about blood tracking. There's a lot of good information on our website. There's also a link, it's right front and center on the website, and it's called Find a Tracker, and you can either click on your state, and then it'll bring up a list of trackers in the state that you're in, or you can punch in your zip code and it'll give you a list of the closest trackers. We also have a Facebook group here in Wisconsin called Wisconsin Deer Tracking Network. So if you search that on Facebook, we also have a list of, I believe there are 20 or 22 trackers that are listed on a map that are all we consider to be certified trackers.
Hmm.
And so there are a lot of good resources out there. My suggestion for anyone who's going to be going into the woods this season is look on the map before you go. Look at the Wisconsin Deer Tracking Network before you go, so that when you do need help with somebody, you're not thinking, oh man, who was I supposed to call? Where was I supposed to find this information? Just have that with you, because we have a lot of folks who we've tracked for that now, if they make a questionable shot, they're still sitting in their tree stands and they're texting us saying, hey, I hit this deer and I don't think it's a great hit. What should I do?
That's
the be prepared. You know, if even if you don't think you're ever going to need a tracker, it's good to have that in your back pocket.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Linda Bennett about deer tracking. She co-owns a business that uses hounds to track wounded deer for hunters, and taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Linda, how did you get into hunting?
Oh, boy. My dad was a hunter, and he was a very avid bird hunter. And I kind of started with him, but as I got to be an adult, I got really interested in bird hunting. And then my husband, Sean, was very interested in archery hunting. So he got me really involved in that. And we own a large boarding kennel in Blue Mounds and train pointing dogs and field dogs and obedience dogs. And we had one year, we had some friends that lost some big deer that they couldn't recover. And we thought, hey, we do all this dog stuff. How come we don't have a tracking dog? So we started getting into tracking dogs. So now we spend all fall either bird hunting or tracking. And it's just great. It's a it's a wonderful way to get outdoors and stay active.
Yeah, I was going to ask, where do you love to go hunting in Wisconsin?
We don't do a lot of bird hunting in Wisconsin. We're fortunate enough to be able to go west, and we like to hunt prairie grouse out there with our pointing dogs. And we do a little bit of deer hunting out of state in Nebraska as well. We like to deer hunt in Wisconsin. We've got some spots where we can go in Wisconsin too, but we sure like to get out as much as we can.
Well, let's take a quick call. Brianne in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Brianne.
Hi there. Good morning. I'm a hunter, hunt a lot of different species, and I've tracked a couple of deer in the last 5 years. Luckily, they've all had blood trails, so I could follow them visually. But I'm interested to know how your guest got into the tracking dogs that she's got, the Bavarian hounds. I've never heard of them before. It just seems really interesting.
Thank you, Brianne. Linda?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking. These Bavarian mountain hounds, are the ones that we own are all European imports. We have two that we brought in from Poland and one from Slovakia. And we picked that breed because in Europe, they are considered to be an elite breed for tracking wounded game. They're very common over there and very heavily used. And we just decided that that would be a good choice for us. And we have just fallen in love with that breed. They're wonderful. They have a wonderful personality and they are really, really good trackers.
How many dogs do you have?
We own 3 Bavarian mountain hounds.
Okay.
And then the rest of our dogs, we own 8 altogether. So then we have a pack of German shorthairs as well that we use for bird hunting.
Well, Linda, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been fun.
Linda Bennett, co-owner of Spring Valley Tracking and Game Recovery. The organization offers tracking for wounded deer with the use of Bavarian mountain hounds that we've been talking about. Just ahead, women who were pioneers in journalism and news coverage of wars. A new biography explores the lives of 3 women who covered major conflicts in Southeast Asia. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.